Hey everybody, I'm Lisa, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to introduce Lori. It's time for our speaker. So, I've known Lori my whole sobriety, over 26 years. And we hadn't seen each other in over 10 years. And when I was tasked with the job to find someone to speak for this beautiful event, I started looking through, you know, all my people. And when I came to Lori's name, I just stopped. I said, that's who I want. And so I called her and left a message, and she sent me this lovely text back and said she would be so honored. And we've gotten together a couple times since then, and we're like a couple of little schoolgirls that you just can't shut us up, you know? And it's been so lovely to reconnect with you. When I think of Lori, the words that come to mind are authenticity, compassion, vulnerability, resilience, service. I could just keep going on and on. She is such a light in this world, and we are so thrilled to have you come share our story. Please help me welcome Lori. Uh-oh, I broke it already. I think that'll work. Hi, everybody. I'm Lori. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lori.
I'm a person in long-term recovery. This is the greatest joy of my life is being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous and having the relationships that I have with the people in this program. And that has always been one of the greatest gifts of my life. And so normally I go chronologically when I tell my story, because I was taught to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, which I certainly will do. But in talking to my wonderful husband, Jordan, about what I wanted to bring tonight, in light of the beauty of telling the truth, I wanted to give the present lens to the story so that I can give the juxtaposition of then and now and really capture it. And so I do want to say that back in 2010, I had a doctor tell me that I had breast cancer. Son of a gun. And I did all I needed to do, and in 2011 was declared to be in remission from breast cancer. Hallelujah. And I went a decade without having to deal with that. And in 2021, almost to the day, a decade later, it was back, and with a vengeance. So it is stage 4 breast cancer, which I like to, you know, alcoholics, we love the drama. I like to say terminal cancer, even though they're probably coming up with the cure as we speak. But I do want to say that being able to have the tools, the people, the faith, the practices, the love, the vulnerability, the willingness to have my, you know, I have a sponsor that told me, you can do self-pity, you get 10 minutes. And so I know, I set a timer and it cracks me up every time. Like, you can't do a full 10 minutes of self-pity. It becomes comical, it's like cartoon-like. But I learned in this program that what I have is today. And that really is, it used to be, to me, when I first came around, an annoying bumper sticker. And I know a lot of us felt that way. The whole just for today thing, they're like, yeah, but look what happened to me, and look what I got to deal with, and how's that going to work out? And but I really want to say that it's the exact tools that I learned in this program, and in my family who worked this program, and friends who worked this program. Like, when we talk about it being, and like, before I was able to have a higher power of my understanding. I used to be bold enough. Jordan said I should speak about my grandiosity a little bit. I used to be bold enough to say, why did they say God as we understand him? Like, there's no way I could ever understand my higher power. And I've even had people in the program say, if you think you can fully understand your higher power, it ain't big enough, right? But I'm not going to rewrite the big book today. I'm going to tell you that I have enough of an understanding of my higher power that it's a real relationship. A real relationship. But before I had that personal relationship with my higher power, it was through people that I believed in what was happening here. Some people say that God stands for good orderly direction, which I needed in the beginning. And some people say it stands for group of drunks, which works for me too. I like that. I today automatically wake up saying, "Thy will, not mine, be done." It's a habit. Some days I pay attention to that more than others. But I really believe it's not even, my boss out in Phoenix used to say, "You don't need faith." And I was like, "What are you talking about? That's ridiculous." And he said, "Well, you have proof. Look around you. It doesn't have to be blind faith. Just look how this program works in the people's lives who are around you. And you have proof that following this direction is going to make things beyond your wildest dreams." So let me now step back and say that when I was a little girl, I had very creative parents, some of the hippies that Dallas was talking about earlier, I think. And they fell in love when, I don't know, my dad was 20 and my mom was 18 or something like that, and got married young and had a wonderful life for a number of years. And at some point, my mother discovered alcohol. And the changes in her were profound. And I have to resist telling her story because she had some hilarious stories. And she was arrested for drunken bicycle riding. And she would climb trees and refuse to come down until she finished her bottle. And she hosted my eighth birthday party in her favorite bar, Good Time Charlie's, outside of Princeton. And my mother was hilarious. My mother was a speaker in AA for a lot of years and was sort of a coveted speaker. And I remember that when she got into recovery on September 1st, 1975, my father started Al-Anon a week later, so his anniversary was September 8th of 1975. And soon after, I wanted to be part of all of that, because what happened was my mom, who had gone from being the most joyous and creative person that I had ever met to the most unhappy and miserable person who used to do things like she'd wax the downstairs floors with my brother and I upstairs and her in the kitchen with the booze, like, and then it would take hours to dry. So she really was isolated. She was miserable. She really hated her life and wanted to die on a number of occasions. And what I saw happen when she became a member of AA when I was 10 years old was that I saw her belly laughter again. I saw her creativity again. I saw her commitment again. I saw her friendships all over the place. We saw less of her because she was always at meetings. She just loved meetings. But when we did see her, she was the best version of my mom that I had ever seen. And so I grew up without stigma attached to AA and alcoholism, which I think is a really rare thing in this society, to grow up knowing that it is a gift to be in this program, not a curse, is pretty incredible. I swore that I was going to do everything I could do so that I would not wind up alcoholic, nor would anybody I cared about. So what did I do? I read the big book as soon as I could read the big book, and I don't know. Remember that book, Go Ask Alice? I was all into all the diaries about addiction and alcoholism. I was reading everything, and I was going to Alateen. And when I was old enough, went to Adult Children of Alcoholics. I was going to Alateen when I was 10, so I felt very mature and very grown up. I loved blending in there. Plus, they were cute boys, so I was very excited. Many of them were getting high in the bathroom, so there's a number of us in the room these days. But I loved that program. And a lot of it, I didn't understand what they were talking about. But I learned that if I said these things, that I was part of the group, if that makes sense. Before my brain was developed enough to get its head around it, and that's just what we became. So we were sort of the traveling circuit speaker family. I would be the Alateen speaker, my father the Al-Anon speaker, my mother the AA speaker. It was hilarious. So here we were like the happy recovering family and talking program, and oh, look at the 11-year-old citing the big book and all of that good stuff. And in high school, I had my first taste of addiction, dare I say this in front of my husband, in the form of a 6'2" blonde named Danny, who I followed around high school. I just thought he was the be-all and end-all, and on the day that he asked me to move my stuff into his locker, I thought I had just, that was nirvana, that was it, as good as it gets. And he kept booze bottles in the locker, so that repetition compulsion thing is real. It's real. And Danny, you know, I was a perfectionist because I thought, and a lot of us are, in a family with addiction, it's not uncommon that we are the heroes, right? Because it distracts from the big mess when you get awards and straight A's and all of, you know, name in the paper and all that kind of stuff. And that was, I was very fond of that at a young age, thus the UT professor. So, I mean, I was really into having the spotlight on me and all that kind of stuff. So I was doing all that. And Danny was kind of on his fifth or sixth year of high school, you know. He was a professional. And Danny hung out with a lot of guys that he felt better around because they had dropped out and started a band called Armageddon. And I played keyboards and sang. So Danny was like, hey, they need a singer and a keyboard player. So by day, I was working at my straight A's on my way to valedictorian. And by night was the screaming Judas Priest, breaking the law into the mic. And I kind of liked the high that gave me, that sort of alternative self, you know. I didn't really need to be drinking the way they all were to feel the revved up that nowadays we know it's dopamine, but whatever the hell it was, it felt good. And we got a couple of gigs, but we weren't very good, actually. The drummer, we liked Rush songs, but he was always on speed, and nobody could keep up with the drummer. It was terrible. And then we did the one gig that we got at the Petty School, which was kind of fancy. They hadn't grounded us well, and I touched the mic, and you know. So they were like, is that part of the act? So, but I did... you know, I was the kind of kid that I would, you know, go around to these settings, and if there was a keg, I'd stand by the keg and count how many drinks everybody had and tell them when they had had enough. So I wasn't invited to many keggers, as you can imagine. So I was just hanging out with the band, and on one really cold night, we practiced in a broken-down barn in New Jersey, and on a really cold night, it was snow outside, and there was no heat, and the lead guitarist handed me a beer and said, this will warm you up. And with everything that I knew about alcohol and alcoholism and my mom and my family and mental illness and everything I had read and all of my meetings, That seemed to make sense to me. So I took that beer, and I still remember it was a moose head. Now that tells you something, right? How many people are that focused on their first drink, right? And the warmth as it went down, and the fact that it was condensing even though it was cold, you know, you're dripping on your hand a little bit. I remember that experience like a magical experience. That was something that my brain registered as one of the most important things that had ever happened to me, because what happened was all of my I'm not good enoughs melted away. I had a second beer and a third beer, and the more I did that, the more I was funny enough, I was pretty enough, I was Stevie Nicks as far as I was concerned on the mic. I don't know what I sounded like, but I, for the first time, felt that whatever was broken that made me feel like I did not belong was fixed. And that's why I understand today, you know, alcohol was my primary drug of choice, although I was known to use whatever I could get my hands on to feel different, and behaviors too. But I have to say that, you know, in NA they call it a fix, and I think I get why. Like, it feels like, oh, this is what I've been missing. And so I told Danny that we should party more often. And the following weekend, we were on a double date, and we went to the movies. And in the car, before we went in, he brought a Bacardi 151 bottle and Dixie cups and 7-Up. And he did the mixing, and I shot back my Dixie cup, and I looked at Danny, and I said, why would anyone? And he said, drink this stuff? And I said, no, mix it with the 7-Up. What on earth is that? Like, I wanted just the stuff. And so, of course, my mother, by this point, was in recovery for a number of years, was an addictions therapist. So Danny said at the end of the evening, oh, by the way, didn't really remember most of the evening. Had little moments where I came in and out, like I remember having a conversation and trying to speak Spanish to my Spanish teacher in the bathroom of the movies. That clearly did not go well. Clearly did not go well. Of course, she blamed my boyfriend. She said, you gotta get yourself a new boyfriend. He's not good. Yes, I do. Si, senora. Danny said, go straight up to bed. If your parents ask, say, I'm not feeling great, go straight up to bed. But I went into the bathroom, I looked at myself, I thought, I look fine. I'm going to kiss my parents goodnight, I don't want them to worry about me. I went in and I hugged and kissed them and I went up to bed. And Danny called me first thing in the morning and said, you went straight to bed, right? And I said, no, said goodnight to my parents. That's the right thing to do. And he said, oh God, look at your clothes. So of course I had gotten sick on myself and I had torn the pants. I had lost a shoe. And honestly, they carried me around so much that evening that I had bruises on my wrists and ankles. So that parents get very worried when they see that. And I still have the diary entry from February 12, 1982 that said, I think I may have a problem with this stuff. That is the last time I am going to drink. And it was until the following weekend. Because I thought, oh, add the 7-Up. Okay. Maybe I was wrong about that. So, drama of dramas. Danny and I broke up so I could go off to college and be single. And I still consider my college years the gray years, because almost from the beginning, there was so much alcohol. And there was never enough at the parties. So there was always pre-partying, drinking in our room before we went out to the parties. And there was all the ugliness that went with it. And I don't even have to tell you about that because everybody knows what that looks like. But I have to say my higher power somehow carried me through this beautiful university enough for me to graduate. And I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was finished there. And my higher power nudged me because other people were like, you know what, you're such a good helping person. Everybody wants to talk to you in the elevator kind of person. You should go to social work school. And I thought, that sounds like a good plan. And I applied to 3 schools of social work. I got into all 3. And on my first, contact with them, I was very nervous because I had no idea what social work was. I literally had never taken a social work course, never met a social worker. So I think it's proof that my higher power was guiding me. But what happened was that summer after I graduated from college was that I was still going to ACOA and thinking that's why I was so miserable was because I had an alcoholic mom. And after the meetings, I would go, the ACOA was right next to my mother's AA group. They were the Hightstown Winners, very proud of that group. They carried my mother through her recovery and gave her some of the best friends of her life. And so I would go see her in that meeting. And I spotted John and asked my mom, is he single? She said, I actually think he's gay. And I said, no, I don't think so. He's looking at me. She's like, well, I don't know. And so I started hanging out with John. And John and I started dating. And I was determined that John would not know I had an alcohol problem because he was 4 years sober. He was living with a group of guys, like 8 guys in a townhouse in Trenton that had like 1 bathroom or something. It was really early version of a halfway house, I guess. But he liked to hike in the woods. My home group ladies know he liked bird watching. And so I'd go out there to Herrontown Woods with John, and I did not get it at all. It was so quiet out there. I liked loud pounding music with a backbeat, you know, and flashing lights and all that. It was so freaking quiet. And he'd be like in the binoculars. I'm like, what am I even supposed to do or say? Like, I had no idea, but I wanted to be around him because he had a clarity in his eyes that I had just not witnessed in anyone my age in a really long time. And he was a weird thinker, you know what I mean? Like we all are, like out of the box, you know, which I love too. And we wound up spending a number of years together. He's the father of my son. Some of you know that we divorced, and after 16 years in this program and in recovery, partially due to his mental illness and depression and anxiety and not being able to really cope, and really the fact that he was not working his own program, I think it was a lot of hanging out with my folks, he resumed alcohol. And it's a very sad story that he was not able to put that back together and was pretty much homeless in Austin. And a lot of people tried to help him in this program. A lot of people in my home group, Bridge to Shore, really carried him. And I have to say Mark Kinsley, who was, you know, in and out of recovery too, really carried him for a while. But he did not survive this illness. And you know, I have to say, that concept of but for the grace of God go I, you know? Not that different, you know? I mean, I have to, you know, we were different, but we had the same disease. And I know that that could be any one of us. So let me jump ahead a few years, because, you know, I got sober because John said, go to a meeting, and I found some cool people, and a woman in my ACOA group became my sponsor because she was in ACOA, AA, and Al-Anon, triple winner. And I said to Shelley, I said, I guess I can't go away to, you know, Pennsylvania for my master's now. And she's like, why? And I said, well, you know, no major changes in your first year, right? Like, I've been around the program. Like, I get that. And she said, how many years of your life have you been in school? She's like, you don't know how not to be a student. Go to school. Like, and I'm very grateful that that was her take. I went away to Philadelphia. And I'm going to include one of my husband's favorite stories. I liked to stick out in meetings. Surprise, surprise. Still working on that. I didn't mind the attention, and I also liked the sense of terminal uniqueness, as we talked about. And so I became a member of the 4021 Club, and if anybody knows what that is, it is a black recovery club. I was the only white Jewish woman in the black recovery club, but I loved the sharing with the hallelujahs, tell it sister, you know, like there was a lot of emotion in the rooms, and that fit me very well. And I got my first sponsor there. She came up, introduced herself, said, my name is Eloise and I'm your sponsor. And I said, oh, Eloise, silly, silly woman. I know this program. I've been around it for a long time. I know I get to pick my own sponsor. And she said, oh, no, not you. Oh, no, no, no. You're too sick. No, 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 no. And I thought, this poor woman, I will bless her with my sponsorship. She'll learn something from me. And Eloise told me what to do, and I would sort of nod at her like she was pathetic and do what she told me to do. And a lot of it was just crazy stuff like brush your teeth with your left hand and walk a different way to work every day. And I knew that wasn't in the big book. And I'm like, okay, Eloise, I'll do that. Yeah. Can you tell me why I'm doing this? No, just do it. Just do it. And then one day she didn't give me any direction. And I was like, Eloise, where's my assignment? And she said, you don't need it anymore. And I said, why? And she said, you stopped asking why. You just followed direction. She said, I've got you a speaking engagement. You have 90 days. You will speak at the 4021 Club, tell your story. Then you will go get another sponsor, because I'm a 90-day sponsor. That's what I'm good at. And you will fly. Be free. Go hit white meetings. That's what she said. That's what she said. Very wise woman. So, but I was going to meetings still that were sort of hardcore in downtown Philadelphia. There was one that they used to call the drink tank, which is not a very nice thing to call us, but we're allowed to use terms like that for ourselves, and the drunk tank or whatever. And there were, you know, donuts and nasty coffee. So sometimes people were drunk there, sometimes they were sober. And I would go, and my heart would pound in my chest, and I would be thinking about what I was going to say, and then I would raise my hand, and I'd get called on, and then I would start emoting and sharing my wisdom. Very early in the program, mind you. And I'm going on and on, very often, you know, crying and sobbing and that whole thing. And a little old man stood up and pointed at me while I was sharing and said, I would rather have cirrhosis of the liver than listen to this woman share one more word. And he stormed out. I'm hoping nobody is thinking, ooh, that's not a bad way to go about it. I did not know how to listen. I love hearing myself talk. Clearly, there's still work to do, but I listen today. And it's part of the reason why when some people say, God, you know, you still go to meetings, you know, 36 years sober, like, what? There's new stuff. And I just know it's my experience that exactly what I need to be not just okay, but to feel like a part of things and useful and loved is in these rooms. And it comes out of the strangest mouths sometimes, right? Right? My group knows my Sheila story. I had to tell the Sheila story. I haven't told my story in a while. I'm going to tell some of my favorite. And I said I was going to reflect back on where I am right now. This is more potent than it's ever been. Because I find that some people are able to talk to me about my illness and ways to make sense out of it and death. And some people are not comfortable in that territory. And so I really have opened my ears again for those that have guidance for me for, you know, all kinds of stuff that I never thought I'd be thinking about at this stage in the game. So I really believe this. So Sheila was a member of my home group in New Jersey, 24-hour club in Princeton, which, by the way, they had these mugs that they put your first name and your sobriety date on it. And literally, there were days I did not drink because I didn't want to have to ask for a new mug. It's not a bad thing, right? Like, hell, I'll go another day. My mug's up there on the wall. Like, talk about pride protecting you, like our character defects being protected. But I was in this meeting, and we'd be sitting there, and every single time, this woman, Sheila, it's a made-up name, but I like to call her Sheila, would come late. And she very often was wearing, like, tight, you know, fake leather pants and stilettos and big hair. And she would always sit across the room, not in the chair closest to the door, so that she could click her way through the middle of the room. So Sheila would come in, and she would always, she'd take her gum out and raise her hand, like, I have something to share. And I would get up and go get coffee. That's how I dealt with that. I couldn't stand to listen to her. Now I know, in hindsight, that it was her attention seeking that was so bothersome to me, because I related with that just a little bit. And I had never thought of the leather pants thing. So, no, but seriously, she would share, I would get up and go. And I had a sponsor named Hope, and Hope said to me one day, I've noticed that you get up and get coffee every time Sheila is sharing. I'm going to tell you, I will fire you if you do not stay for Sheila's share, and I'm going to quiz you afterwards on what she said. And I was like, Hope, don't, please don't do this to me. She's like, your choice. It's okay. You can find another sponsor. And I really liked. So sat there with my hands under my body just so that I wouldn't like get really angry. And Sheila, of course, took out her gum and raised her hand. She said, my name is Sheila. I'm an alcoholic. I want you all to know that I used to have anxiety. Now she's got my attention. I had never heard somebody say they used to have anxiety, like it was a past tense thing. So I'm listening. And of course, I still remember what she said because my sponsor was quizzing me. She said, what I had learned in this program from somebody very wise is that when my heart is pounding in my chest like this, that I'm supposed to think about it as God knocking to get my attention, and I'm supposed to take a deep breath and say a prayer and then blow out. Yeah, take in God, out self. And son of a gun, do you know what I do when I'm feeling anxious? To this day, when I'm teaching a big class or whatever it is, like I feel the pounding. I think, oh, God's knocking. I breathe in God, out self, and I do what I need to do. That's miraculous. She probably saved me not just from relapse, but from many worse things. And so it really is a thing that it doesn't matter if you like everybody in this program. We're not going to like everybody. People are too complex, right? I mean, and people in our mind who, maybe I'm making fun of her accent. Some of you are going to be like, oh, that's Baker. I couldn't listen. You know, fingernails on a chalkboard, you know, whatever. Some people are attracted to some people and not others, right? That's why they say to find a sponsor that has what you want and do what they did, right? Because the way I work my program is the way my sponsors work their program may be very different than the way other people have worked their program. Right? So, and sometimes I need different things in different stages of my life, right? You know? And so, I think if I had to share with you my favorite line in the Big Book of any of them, actually, it's not the Big Book, it's the 12 and 12. And it's in step 10. And it says something like, we come to realize that we are all, to some degree, including ourselves, emotionally ill and frequently wrong. And that's when we become capable of true love and tolerance. Think about that for a second. We are all emotionally ill and frequently wrong. And that's when we become capable of true love and tolerance. And I have to say, back in the days when I was in my active addiction, I didn't know from peers. When I met you, I ascertained in the first 30 seconds, are you smarter than me or dumber than me? Are you prettier than me or uglier than me? Are you, you know, whatever it was, I was comparing myself to you and doing the hierarchy thing. But it is such a lonely place. Such a lonely place to be figuring out where you are in that hierarchy, as opposed to everyone. I'm going to put it differently. My friend Annie says, there is no such thing of anyone being more worthy of God's love than another individual. She actually put me to the challenge of caring about my person that picked up my garbage as much as I cared about my family. And that baffled me when I first heard it. That baffled me. I was like, that doesn't make any sense at all. And today it makes perfect sense to me. And in this program, we learn that because we need each other. And the people who lean on us and that we lean on aren't necessarily our perfect peers in every way, right? It's just that we get what we need because our higher power puts the right person there at the right time, the right group. You know, my Jordan and I were joking about how he was asking, you know, did you go to Allendale? And I was like, yeah, I think I was one of the persons that, like, was trying to find Northland and turned in too soon because it's on AA sign, you know. It's like, I think a lot of us found this meeting that way. Thank God for the AA. Still out there, right? amen, it worked. My mother also used to say that, what was her favorite line? She used to say, all it takes to start a new group is a coffee kettle and a resentment. I love that. That's not how this group started, but some groups start that way. Let's see. I have about 5 more minutes, so I want to talk about service. My father died of cancer a few years back. And as annoying as it might have been, I, every single day, would say, tell me another bit of wisdom, Dad. That's the problem with having a social worker as a daughter. And he'd say, oh, God, more wisdom? All right. But his favorite line was, it's an inside job. And he used to worry about me a lot because he knew that I liked getting my name in the paper and getting those awards and having my picture up and, you know, getting all the attention and stuff. And he took very seriously the Al-Anon Just for Today and the line that says, do something kind for somebody else and don't get found out. If anyone knows about it, it doesn't count. And I have to tell you, I was like, so what kind of things do you do? He's like, can't tell you. He's like, you're going to have to figure it out because I don't want you to know my things. And I have to tell you, it's one of the hardest things to do. Like, when I first started practicing this principle, I would do it, and then I'd say to my sponsor, you won't believe how good I feel today, because look what I did. She'd say, I thought your dad said I'm not supposed to know. So I told her that, fortunately. There is something about the being the kind of person you want to be without doing it so everybody loves you. Without doing it so that you get the accolades and the awards and the praise. Because that's the stuff that's between me and my higher power today. And I don't do it nearly as well as my dad did. I know I don't. Because I'll go whole days and I'll be like, shit. I didn't do anything nice for anybody else that I didn't tell anybody about. There are plenty of things I did that definitely made it known. I think that here's the coolest piece about having worked the program with the basic tools being still what I use all the time, and I work the steps. I mean, I have a very cool sponsor that sometimes gets it, that I don't have to do them like numbers on a clock. Sometimes I can do 10, 11, and 12 and maintain. Other times, she's like, you're back to the AA waltz. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, because there's... you're missing some God in there. And the other thing that we do sometimes is I work the steps about something specific, right? So I'll be like, I am not letting go of my adult child. And she'll be like, well, you're powerless over what happens to him and your life has become unmanageable. And I can do that work and become different because of it. So, but all of those tools have led to me being more comfortable than I've ever been in my whole life. I used to be a worrier. I was packed with anxiety. I always had a sensation of that imposter syndrome, not good enough. And now I know that by God's guidance, I do and am exactly what I need to be, even when I screw up. Like, how profound is that? There are times where I come to my home group and dissolve. I dissolve into pieces because I'm scared or I'm upset or I'm angry. And nobody loves me any less. In fact, I have people always come up to me and say, will you sponsor me? You're so vulnerable. I go, yeah, now's not the time. That's pretty funny. I love my life. I love my family. I love my husband. I love my girlfriends. I love these rooms. I do not love cancer, but I see the gifts that it's given me in terms of being able to prioritize what is really important. You know, I think it might have been Eloise that used to say, the number of pubs you write is not what you're going to want on your gravestone, believe me. You know, like, what is really important? And because of that inside job piece, I am not even afraid of dying. Does that mean I'm not scared at times about it? No. Does that mean that I'm not kicking and screaming because I want to stay around as long as I possibly can? Absolutely. And I can't even imagine my family without me. or my home group without me. So I don't go there most of the time, but I'm not living in anticipation of that and trying to make sense out of it, because I know that when that time comes, it'll be exactly what it's supposed to be. It'll be exactly what it's supposed to be. And I've had so many of my favorite people in this program model what that looks like. My sponsor, Beverly, had cancer. I don't know if you knew Beverly S. Beverly Scarborough was a magnificent woman who identified in public as being a person in recovery. And she taught me how to laugh with cancer. I remember I visited her at hospice, and she said, it was kind of amazing. She's like, first of all, change the music that my sister has on. She thinks I like classical music. But don't tell her. Tell her that you want to hear something different. Okay. And then I said, how are you doing, Beverly? Like, this is crazy. And she said to me, it's the longest fucking goodbye I've ever had to say. Like, that is a great attitude. Like, who gets to joke like that? Delano Womack. Many of you know Delano. Delano, I really thought that when Delano saw me, he was seeing his favorite person. But anybody that went to his funeral knows that we all thought we were his favorite person. That's the kind of person I have learned to be. I love people. I do. Broken, put together, there's no difference. We're all broken and put together, like mosaics. It's just who we are, and it's the way that it works. But I have fun in my life. We are not a glum lot is the truth. There are a lot of heavy things we get through together, but we laugh our butts off, and we see the light in so much of this crazy world. And I you're all my beacons and my batteries and my strength in ways that I can just never, ever describe. So I love you deeply. And please, if there's something that, you know, the bottom line here is that our brains are programmed to think about feeling different when we are stressed or in pain. And when that happens, the way that it works is that the answer lies in these rooms with these people that are surrounding me today. So please reach out if you need some money. I love you. I love you. Thank you. Oh my God.
Sold tickets or did something to make this happen with your stamp.
Woo! Awesome! Woo, 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 woo!
Okay, Sally, can you come up here and tell us something important before we close?
You know it.
This is Lisa's. This is not mine.
That's not mine.
Lisa. I think this is Lisa's.
Good evening, everyone. Sally Alcoholic.